Ribono Shel Olam, we enter into this study to draw close to you for the sake of holy service and the fulfillment of your will for us and for all of Israel and for this entire planet. Please assist our efforts and guide our understandings. Let us internalize your Torah to the depths of our being so that we become transformed by your will and its truths. Let neither ourselves nor anyone else come into stumbling as a result of this study. Gal einai v'abita niflaot mitoratecha. Okay, so we're kind of really nearing the end of the book, and we have one section left, which is the shame entailed in cultivating Ani, the feminine path of enlightenment. So that's what we're going to do tonight. And I want to go slowly through it because there's a lot of material there. There's a lot of teachings there that that we need to take to heart and to mind, but also to heart. So, and that comes at the end of like kind of looking closely at the deepest pulse in the universe, really, Kabbalistically, is the pulse of Ani, Ayin, Ayin, Ani, Ani, Ayin, Ayin, Ani, which is Hashem's like kind of extending into creation, and creation exists. Creation ceases to exist in the blink of an eye and is reconstituted moment by moment by moment. And so the rectified expression of shame is really the ain state, the no self, no ego state, and the rectified expression of ani, the rectified expression of narcissism is the ani state, is the kind of rectified ego that we've talked about a number of times that is really kind of the feminine modality of cultivating right selfhood. And so we looked at Rebbe Akiva as the archetype of the motion from Ani to Ayin, from strong self to humble self. And we looked at Chava as the archetype of the complementary motion from no self, late Lami Grama Klum, she has nothing of her own, only what she receives from her son, her Ben Zug, and moving into rectified Ani-ness, which is the Eim Kol Chai, Chava, is the mother of all life, and the kind of being able to cultivate a sense of self that is nimble and able to adapt to whatever is happening, and yet in it's compromising in that sense, but also strong in its core. So, and that process of coming into cultivating selfhood or ego state in the rectified sense of the word is there's a lot of sand traps of shame along the way that needs to be negotiated. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. So let's see, let's share screen here, hopefully. Okay, so there are two ways. So we've talked about that there are something that's been a theme, like after every chapter, it kind of really comes down to how to this idea of there are two ways that shame contributes something positive to growth and transformation. Because one of the premises of the whole book is that no one escapes shame. That's clear. And if that's the case, then Hashem must have had some good reason for why he brought shame into the universe and made it so ever present and inescapable. It must be serving the purpose of creation in some real way. And the purpose of creation, as we understand it, as we kind of developed earlier on in the book, that the purpose of creation is actualizing the potential of relationship between Hashem and us, Hashem and creation, Hashem and the Shekhinah. And so, how does,
Siri,
yes?
please increase the volume on my laptop now.
Oh, okay. Okay. So where was I? I got distracted by that. Okay. So that's what we're going to talk about is, and I don't know the sentence here about anticipating judgment, my soul grows nauseous. It certainly doesn't belong here, but I'm not sure where it popped in here from. So we're going to ignore that for now.
Sorry, Deed.
Yes.
Well, Kasima.
Hi, Malcolm.
Is shame the darkness that the light shines better in front of? Like the
Oh,
is that
the contrast that Adam and Hava chose in eating from the Eitz Hadat.
just seems like in
Is
our
that what you're saying?
process that some ways, I mean, I was thinking about, I listened to last week's class. The way that Galui, you were saying Galut and Galui and the revealed Chava wanting.
Kasima, can you speak louder, sweetheart?
Sure.
It's me,
We can't
Khaliba. Can
hear
you?
you. We
I
can't hear
can't
you.
hear you. Yeah.
I wonder why. Hold on. I don't know. Is this better if I talk louder?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. So the Galui and Galut, that when some, that the background needing some darkness as a background for the light to shine more. And well, one, I just think of the Me'or Vashemesh and Miriam HaNevi'ah and this time where the we need our bodies. To for the consciousness for the light to come into our bodies, which are the darkest, like the nefesh, it's the most concealed or dark kind of background of our soul. And so the light bringing the consciousness, like that's the final step. We're bringing the light and the consciousness down into that being this final revelation. In is dependent on consciousness in the body. And when you get into the body, the shame shows that that's where our trauma is and our like that's why people stay up here. One of the reasons is because you're gonna meet. I'm just like shame's the back. Shame is that kind of dark background against which then the healing and the light's revealed. Is that
Maybe,
clear? Fair to
maybe.
say?
I mean, certainly there are a lot of dark nooks and crannies in our world, and the body is kind of on the darker, it is opaque. It is what introduces opacity into the world. And that opacity, in the largest sense of the word, is what Adam and Chava understood that they needed to bring that in order to that the light, the contrast of the light and the opacity, and the increasing of the light through their mitzvah practice or spiritual practice, would be more meaningful against the backdrop of opacity and darkness. So, I think the body is part of that on some level.
And on the level that it's that trauma is stored in our cells and our emotions are in our organs and the viscera, the revealing the kind of bringing healing to our shame is a kind of on the backdrop of that is the backdrop
Yeah, in a sense, that's true. I mean, it's the entire everything that's opaque in our world is really the backdrop, and it includes that, but it's not exclusive to that, what you're
Is it
saying.
all shame, though? Is it all, it's all infused with shame?
It shame being the how do I define shame again? As the
Diminishment or discomfort of the
no.
ego?
The discomfort produced when the ego feels diminished or deflated. So there is, to whatever extent that is present, to that extent there's shame. But it's, there's beauty in opacity as well. So it's more complicated than that.
Thank you.
Okay, so there are two ways that shame contributes something positive, at least so far as we've come to. We're going to come to a third one in a moment. There are two ways that shame contributes something positive to growth and transformation. One is shame as a precursor to humility associates primarily with the path from Ani to Ayin, where the Ayin is really present already in the humility, so to speak, and the Ayin is already present in the Ani state, in the ego state, and it needs to, but it's all gunked up with Klipa, and so it needs to be, like the hide of the ego needs to be tanned. Its hide needs to be tanned so that it becomes flexible and then eventually becomes permeable to light. So primarily with the masculine path of Ani to Ayin as explored, where really there is the cultivation of humility, which is really the kind of psychological expression, you might say, or the healthy expression of the Ani modality of the Ani to Ayin path. And then there's shame as a negative incentive associates with the feminine path of Ayin to Ani, which is the, well, it's going to explain. I'm gonna do it. Okay, so shame as negative incentive. Which is which we're going to talk about in relation to the path of individuation, which is the feminine path of moving from Ayin, from no self to yes self, refined self, cultivated self. And so, how does shame play out there? The second way that shame contributes positively to our growth path is as an extremely potent negative incentive. In trying to avoid or minimize the presence of shame in our life, because shame is spiritual nausea. It's a very, very uncomfortable state of being. It's hard to find any way to just sit in peace when there is a shame spasm upon you. So in trying to avoid or minimize its presence in our life, we must grow, mature, and enlighten. Shame is an aversive emotion that we want to be rid of as quickly as possible. That's just kind of how it works. And so to minimize the amount of shame in our lives, we try to avoid doing things that will bring shame.
Take a plate and you could take a spatula.
Someone's Michelle, you're
I'm
right.
sorry, yep.
Yeah. So to minimize the amount of shame in our lives, we try to avoid doing things that will bring shame, which basically means making wise decisions, being honest, cultivating integrity, minimizing secrets, keeping promises, and just generally being a mensch. But it's also true that sometimes integrity, but there's another way that shame plays into this, which is that it's also true that sometimes integrity requires that a person not be intimidated by the threat of shame. and instead find the courage to do what's right, despite the risk of being shamed by those who think otherwise. It's actually something that's really alive and well and up in these days, which is with the rising of anti-Semitism, there is this whole tension of how public is a person going to be with their Jewishness, and are they going to, kind of hide and allow and be intimidated to kind of sh not show their Jewish star or whatever it is, or are they going to stand up in pride and hold their identity as a Jew? Or there are all kinds of things that come up in life. There's always stories about someone who has a sibling that is maybe a little bit like on the spectrum, so to speak. And so his classmates shame him. And is his brother or sister going to stand up in pride for him, or is he going to join in the shaming? So those kinds of questions come up, and they really are tests of integrity for us, and also kind of come up in our efforts, our striving towards individuation, where we're going to get to that. So in fact, as we will explore below, there's a certain amount of shame that is built into the individuation process. Consequently, in the spiritual journey from Ayin to Ani, from no self to yes self, one must be willing to stand firm and honor one's values despite the shame that it elicits. At the same time, one must also have the humility to change one's course if new information really does change one's mind and alter one's truth. So there's a very, it's complicated. It's not like one size fits all. There's paradoxes involved in the individuation process and how to stay, which requires a certain commitment to that process, and a kind of stubborn commitment to it, and at the same time, a flexibility or a willingness to keep an open mind, and if information to allow truth to invite truth to come in and to be transformed by it, and to be willing to do so if you encounter truths that really are like require you to face them and actually to change your position or thinking or understanding based on this new information. And so how to hold both of those imperatives of, on one hand, being committed to unpacking the beauty and the mystery of your soul, and which we'll see is a requires a certain stubborn commitment to that aim, and at the same time, be malleable, flexible to be able to take in information that might alter your understanding of things and change your path in some profound way. So, and as I kind of always say, unless you're grappling with paradox, you're not in truth. So it is a paradox, and it is kind of an awkward tension to hold, but it really is essential to being in truth. Hashem deemed that the world be built from prima materia saturated with shame. So that's we talked about at the beginning, the seven universes created and destroyed, were seven kings who ruled narcissistically and died shamefully when their whole kingdom shattered. And then we're built from the raw materials of those shattered worlds that are just drenched, saturated in shame and narcissism. So we come in really with work to be done. And so learn, and we're having to learn. Wait, someone's making noise. So we're learning to metabolize that shame.
May I ask a question?
Okay. Well, wait, let me say a little more. So Hashem deemed that the world be built from primal. Wait, that somebody's.
There's a reverb.
I think if everybody mutes, then it will cut that issue out.
Right. So wait a minute. And I can't, somehow my controls are not at the bottom of my screen like they're supposed to be, because I would make you the co-host, but I can't.
Yeah, you want.
I can't find the control for that. Okay, just people take responsibility for it themselves. Please, everybody, mute.
Yes, and Malcolm, I just want, I'm so sorry, Robinson. Malcolm, also, your voice is so light. It's really hard for us to hear you. Just FYI, if you're going to speak again.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know where. Okay. So.
Maybe when you end the screen share, you could see your controls.
But then oh, there, it just came up. Wait a minute. Okay. Participants. Makasima. Okay. Makasima, make co-host. Confirm. Okay. Makasima, you are co-host. I guess you're muted, so you can't answer me. Okay. I can't get back to that though. Okay. So we are built from primal material, from raw materials that are saturated with shame and narcissism, and we have to learn to metabolize that shame, to kind of work with it, that somehow learning to metabolize that shame must contribute something crucial to our mission. So to understand what that might be, let's examine the fine print of our job description, which we discussed way earlier on in the book. We're operating under the premise that actualizing the potential of relationship with Hashem is the purpose of creation. Our job as sparks of the universe encompassing Shekhinah is to enable that relationship by functioning as an other vis-a-vis the Creator, while simultaneously knowing and declaring that despite appearances to the contrary, there really is nothing but the One. That's another paradox, is that our raison d'etre, the reason that we are here, is to be in relationship with Hashem, but to be in relate to be a party in a relationship requires that we be an other, that we be other than Hashem, that Hashem is in relationship to us as an other. And yet a relationship is seeing and being seen, knowing and being known. What is the most essential truth of Hashem that he wants us to see and recognize, like in the intimacy of relationship, is seeing and being seen, knowing and being known. So in that intimacy of relationship, what does Hashem want us to see? Which is his oneness. And yet his oneness pulls the rug out from under our very existence. So that's another paradox that actually requires inherent in it a dance between Ani and Ayin, Ani and Ayin, declaration, like the perceiving and declaring of Hashem's oneness, really kind of we have to be in a state of Ayin in order to be able to do that, because otherwise our very existence compromises that oneness. And yet our whole point is to be an other, witnessing and beholding Hashem, and so there we need to be an Ani, and and have the strength of aninus in order to be able to bear and not melt down in our encounter with the divine. So that's a dilemma, that's a paradox that is really inherent, like kind of the core in a certain way of a spiritual life. And the shame is the coarse expression. Shame and narcissism are the coarse expressions of Ani and Ayin. And as we move through life, we hopefully become more and more refined in our dance between self, yes self, no self, which in its coarsest form, as I just said, is shame and narcissism, and its refinest form is Ani and Ayin. Okay, our job as sparks of the universe encompassing Shrina is to enable that relationship by functioning as an other vis-a-vis the creator, while simultaneously knowing and declaring that despite appearances to the contrary, there really is nothing but the one. Okay, well, I see people are wanting to ask questions, but I want to get through this paragraph first. The mechanism Hashem devised to produce this other is complicated, i.e. us, is complicated indeed. And shame plays a central role from beginning to end, as we've seen so far and as we're going to discuss now again. The very stuff out of which we are built is, as I said, is saturated with narcissistic shame produced by the era of shattered vessels and reinforced by our apparent blunder with the Tree of Knowledge. Tikkun Olam is nothing but the transmuting of this dross into gold, into the deepened relationship with Hashem that is our mission and our pleasure. What's the dross? The dross is the narcissistic shame that was produced by the era of shattered vessels, which was the means by which Hashem brought the impurity of shame and narcissism into the world, which produces a self that is coarse in its immaturity, that we need to spend basically the rest of our life and incarnations refining and tanning and refining and tanning. But there is, as also we've said before, is that there is some reshimu of that dross that has a certain stubborn quality to it, that is what enables us to actually consummate our relationship with Hashem without being melting down from the power of the Ein Sof, of the Or Ein Sof, meaning that that even in our most refined, achieved, enlightened consciousness, there is still going to be this trace, this reshimu of this that has of the shame narcissism stuff, but it won't look like shame and narcissism anymore. But anyway, it is essential to our being able to step into our consummate relationship with Hashem and not be overwhelmed by that and melt down. And so it's a process of paring away at the opacity and the coarseness, but it's leaving the essence of the material, of the prima materia of the shame, narcissism, gunk, but it won't be gunk anymore. It will be gold. I hope you understood what I was saying. I don't think I explained it so well, but okay. Who someone had some questions?
Yeah, I had my hand up. I don't know if there's anybody before me.
Rebecca, I
Go ahead,
think you're.
Wendy. Ah.
Okay, just I'm confused about to start with, like, why seven narcissistic kings? It's weird. I'm just trying to make sense of.
Well, it's not a, you know, it's not kings really. It's like in the intro to that, wait a minute. The Torah speaks in the language, no, before that. The Kabbalistic tale we're about to explore transpired at levels of reality that are beyond human conception. These kings are not human beings with crowns, and these worlds are not nation states, planets, or even galaxies. They are not physical. There is no opacity to them. They are subtle, abstract, energetic processes unfolding within the mind of God that Kabbalah has clothed in a teaching tale about shattered worlds in order to make this profoundly relevant chapter of prehistory comprehensible to us.
Is that in this book?
Yes,
Sorry, what page was that? Do you remember? Sorry. Didn't know this in your sleep.
Page 47.
Okay, thank you.
So maybe in the luminosity, like in the, I mean, with Hashem's beyond everything, that quality, trying to bring it in, if it's separated out, creates the grandiosity if it's not matched with the humility. Is it like that?
Yeah, I mean, well, I'm not sure what you're referring to, but yeah, I mean, that's the starting point, and then in order to, like, we're going to talk about the different stages and how it, I think it will be, you will be answered in what's to come.
Thank you. Can I throw in one more quick thing? When we talk about Hashem as one and we're really all one, and I think of the world and I think about all of the things that I don't want to unify with as one, all our parts of the world and the crazy, what are we supposed to do with that? Like, it's all one. And I'm like, okay, so we're united with horrible things in the world. That's not what
Right.
that's not what's being said, right? Is there another
Yeah,
framework for that?
that's the book I'm working on now, which is no, which is there it, is that it's not so the whole idea of Hashem Echad is absolutely true, but on one level of reality, and when Hashem comes into revelation, Hashem splits into tunis, into light-filled expanse and dark womb-like tsimsum, and so then there is then all the polarities of the world come up, and that's what we kind of which they ultimately do reconcile back into one, but it's that's what I'm the that's what I'm working on now.
Okay, thank you.
Wendy,
Sorry, Hootie, do you
yeah,
have, oh, sorry.
Wendy,
Do you have something?
yeah.
Sorry.
Okay,
So
to speak.
what? Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if you can comment. I'm just, it just seems to be so much more complex. You can work really, really hard at trying to hold on to your integrity and your truth. And then you have an interaction with a narcissist, and suddenly you find yourself reacting. You've lost your truth, and you're left feeling ashamed because they've done it to you again. And I just wonder, it's all very well to say, yeah, being on the road of truth and integrity, but it's so difficult in the actual interaction.
Right, but that's, you know, I mean, it's something, it's worth the effort. That's kind of what, like, nobody said it was going to be easy to get from here to there. But that is like we are developing muscles and wisdom and insight and all kinds of resources that we need in order to find our way through life and make the best of it. And it's certainly going to be worth its while when we get into the growth through joy reward phase of history called Mashiach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, so I'm going to go on unless there's Malka
I see
Sima,
it.
it says.
Yeah, I also had something to say. I see L also.
Yeah, so I feel like it seems like there's a choice between becoming the narcissist or being ashamed in these moments. And neither one of them sounds like the choice, but being ashamed is better than being the narcissist, in my opinion. I don't know. Can you expand on that?
Well, no, I think we have both of them. I think we're having to deal with, I think every person has to deal, and it's true, we're on the spectrum, so to speak, of both shame and narcissism, and we have our tendencies, and we just have to do the best we can do and try to find someone that will match us, and we match them, and somehow we are able to kind of build relationships and families and all that. And it's not as, it's not all shame and narcissism. There's life is entails a lot more than that. But in the backdrop of things, that's something that's a primary thing that we need to sort out.
Okay.
The mechanism Hashem devised to produce this other, i.e., us, is complicated indeed. And shame plays a central role from beginning to end, as we've seen. Oh, I read this already. Kabbalah, let's see. Kabbalah informs us that that relationships have a life cycle. So this is the book, Kabbalistic Writings on the Nature of Masculine and Feminine, is all about this. The seven stages of the feminine development, which is really the seven stages of the evolving relationship of masculine and feminine, and the but those seven stages break down into three primary stages. The first one is back-to-back enmeshment. So, and then it's kind of described in with Adam and Chava, is that they were originally came the Midrashim and understand the that Adam and Chava in their archetypal sense were originally created as a kind of androgyne, as a Siamese twins, back to back, bound back to back. Then a surgical uncoupling that released them to turn. Stage two is a surgical uncoupling. They're now able to turn face to face, but in that surgical uncoupling, the feminine diminished, and in stage three of their front to front, so their quality of relationship increase because it's a front to front instead of back to back. It's conscious to conscious, heart to heart instead of back to back. But so it's front to front or consummate encounter, but it takes the Shekhinah, or it takes the feminine quite a bit of time to regain her stature. Eventually they will meet. This is in the language of the Ari. Panim b'panim shaveh legamrei, face to face, and completely equal, which is quite a an evolved notion of relationship between masculine and feminine, face to face and completely equal. Front and back here in this scenario refer to the conscious and unconscious layers of the soul. Since front includes the face, eyes, and sense organs that comprise our field of awareness, Kabbalah employs that term to convey conscious will, actualized potential and personalized expression. It's, all very positive qualities, whereas the back associates with all that is unconscious, instinctive, compulsive, unexamined, and transpersonal. In a back-to-back relationship, the glue that, so the idea being that this evolving of relationship between masculine and feminine is also one of the, is describing one of the larger cosmic processes that are happening in creation and that we are participating in. So, in a back-to-back relationship, the glue, which is the kind of unconscious to unconscious relationship, the glue that binds the parties is from unconscious compulsive forces that may even oppose their stated conscious intent. In contrast, a front-to-front relationship is one where the parties share common goals and a mutuality of desire, at least to some extent. To turn a back-facing union into a front-facing one, there must be an intervening nisi-ra, or surgical uncoupling, that severs the former to enable the latter. Literally, the Torah describes Hashem coming in and surgically uncoupling Adam and Chava, allowing them to turn face to face. Every relationship has elements of both. Like, as we become more self-aware, so there is more content, so to speak, in our psyche that is available to enter into relationship. And so the in the course of the in the course of the of it, like say a marriage, so the as the individuals mature, so they are able to they there is like there is an ongoing nisi-ra that releases aspects of each partner to be able to now turn from unconscious to conscious and begin to meet their partner face to face. And as we move through, as the relationship runs its course, and as the collective relationship between the Shekhinah and HaKadosh and Hashem runs its course through the history of creation, so there is this turning, this like each cycle of me, this it's hard to explain, but the relationship matures, and the maturing really is that different, that new levels of each person's personality and psyche are person is each one is becoming more self-aware, and in that self-awareness there's more and more content, personality content that is available for meeting. When it talks about a relationship that is panim b'panim shaveh legamri, face to face and completely equal, so the panim for is the word for face, but it's also panimiyut, which is core. So the really the maturing of the relationship is that it becomes more of a relationship of core to core, of each of moving from more superficial encounter of self and other to a more intimate and core encounter of self to other. And that's the direction that we're moving in. So to turn a back-facing union into a front-facing one, there must be an intervening nisi-ra, a surgical uncoupling that severs the former to enable the latter. Kabbalah further informs us that this striving for a more perfect front-to-front union is driven and directed by the Gevurot. I'm really feeling how complicated, like the language here and the paradigms It really is the Kabbalah of shame, not the psychology of shame. I'm sorry about that because it's a little bit abstruse and it's not so simple to explain unless, except, for people that don't have all the textual underpinnings of all the layers of source text that is behind all this. But I'm doing the best I can do. Okay, so yeah.
I on Shabbat. I don't know. Do you want to wait for a question or for a reflection?
Maybe, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So Kabbalah further informs us that this striving for a more perfect front-to-front union, like it's driven, it's not a water flowing downhill. It's really an unpacking. It requires an investment of effort and energy in order to drive the process of individuation and evolving relationship. As I think we all know, that life is a lot of work and it really takes a lot of effort and blood, sweat, and tears to grow through all the challenges and to really make the best of them. And it's very satisfying work when we get to the other side of our test or our challenge, but it really is a lot of work. And so Kabbalistically, that mechanism of work that's kind of driving the whole thing forward is by this what are called gevurot, which are these dark knots of unactualized potential produced in the era of shattered vessels, which serve as creation's propellant. These gevurot, they're like springs that have been like flattened. And they're just seeking to be able to unpack themselves and to kind of drive us and creation onward to our destiny. And so but they are also in their, they have a life cycle themselves, which is as dark knots of unactualized potential. They are very unevolved and unconscious. And so in their pushing towards unpacking themselves, they create a lot of chaos. And that's kind of part of the challenge of things is to kind of work with them and to allow ourselves to be grown to be grown by them to for them to press out and force forward, force upward our growth and transformation, and yet kind of also contain them at the same time. So these dark knots of unactualized potential produced in the era of shattered vessels are creation's propellant. Like that is like, where does the energy come from to push creation forward? Like it seems like the natural inclination of things is to choose the path of least resistance, like water, to just flow down, whereas these gevurot are pushing in the opposite direction, and they are the source of our of the they're the propellant to creation's forward motion. These gevurot and really the Leshem is kind of a like much of his writing. A lot of Kabbalah focuses on the chasadim, which are more, consciousness lights, quiet, calm, consciousness lights, as opposed to the gevurot that are kind of wild and unruly, dark consciousness lights, dark knots of unactualized potential. The Leshem spends like a lot of time, in some sense, this whole sefer is primarily about the gevurot and their role in our personal lives and in our collective life. So these gevurot are, and the gevurot and the chasadim are also partners to each other, soulmates as well. The gevurot, the way that the gevurot are tamed and the way they evolve is by absorbing chasadim, absorbing the more watery consciousness, the gevurot are more fiery. And so the gevurot are never still. They're always seeking to improve their condition, an effort that proceeds on two fronts, cleaning out their zohama, their impurity or filth, the narcissistic shame that they inherited from the Shvira and the tree of knowledge, as explained, and two, actualizing their glorious potential. So they're cleaning out impurities and actualizing their glorious potentials, which also hark back to those primordial times when those universes. The kings ruled and died, universes shattered. The shards of those shattered worlds contain the gevurot and the chasadim. They contain, but primarily the gevurot, they contain all the potentials that are going to unpack in the course of history, in the course of the millennia of human history. And also all the impurities that are the producing the illusion of other than God, which is basically the definition of evil. So all the glory that we're going to manifest and when we get to our finish line and beyond are all just unpacking what the hidden lights of the Gevurot and also but also all the impurities that we are grappling with and burdened by and are assigned and have the assignment of cleaning and cleaning out the impurities of the Gevurot as well. So actualizing their potential and cleaning out their impurities. Both of those tasks are really primarily centered around these gevurot. And gevurot are different from gevura. Gevura, chesed, and gevura are two of the spheros, but chasadim and gevurot are really a much higher level where they're really kind of on the level of Ein Sof.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Are there always, if there's always got to be in this paradigm of the world, resistance, right, to have free will, right? There's always got to be the Sitra Achra. So does that mean there's always going to be a recreation of Gevurot to keep, in other words, while
It's
we're in the state?
not a recreation. It's like they shattered and fell into a like kind of into a tahome, and they just layer after layer becomes present, enters into it. Its time comes for it to participate in the Tikkun Olam. And so we scrape off that level of froth, so to speak, and that's the task for this millennium, and then more arise, and that's the task for the next. And it's not that they're being recreated, they're just coming up into the light of day in order to be in order to be cleaned and actualized.
It's like always a supply is coming.
Yeah, but they are finite. They are finite, and so there will be an end.
Thank you.
Okay,
Yeah.
I really want to get to the end of this section, but okay. When progress occurs on either front, so right, when progress occurs on either front, it leaves us more individuated and our relationship with Hashem more consummated. For says Kabbalah, actualizing self and deepening relationship are just two sides of the same coin. The more we bring our self fully and wholly out into the world, the more of us is available for a deepened relationship with Hashem or with the people around us. Okay, a phase three, front-to-front, consummate relationship is one where each of the parties is fully actualized. But that can only happen once they have achieved their full stature. They have unpacked the full potential and beauty that is theirs. And at that point, they can finally meet in consummate union, core to core and tip to toe. That's where we're headed. We all have a quota of gevurot whose potential we need to unpack, and those impurities we need to, and whose impurities we need to scour. Some of these gevurot have already begun their journey of awakening, and as such comprise our conscious self. Other of these gevurot remain as collapsed and tainted as ever, yet in that condition, their distinguishing features are complete in their completely like unpacked form state. Their distinguishing features are completely hidden. Instead, they all look the same. They all look like dark cinders of light laced with narcissism and shame. Only once they activate and begin to unfurl does their uniqueness poke through. It's kind of like the difference between flower buds, which in their bud state are basically all look alike, versus in their when the calyx, I think that's what it's called, the calyx breaks or splits, they unpetal, and they are these amazing flowers with a magnificent variety of colors and petal shapes and fertilization strategies. And it's just amazing, the plant kingdom. But in their bud state, you can't tell one from the other. So the gevurot, in their unpacked state, they just look like dark knots of dark cinders, metaphorically speaking. But in their unpacked state, they look like each one of us, like unpetaled, the beauty that we bring and shine, each one of us, to the world. To summarize, okay, so our job is to achieve a consummate relationship with Hashem. The path from here to there has three steps to it. Each of these steps entails some processing and mastery of shame. In their back-to-back state on the physical plane, and this is all the process of the feminine path of enlightening, of individuating, bringing forth a self, individuating and enlightening. On the physical plane, closeness means literally proximity. On the non-physical planes, things are close when they're similar and distant when they're different. Consequently, in their still fallen state, the gevurot bond around their shared taint inherited from the era of shattered vessels, which serves as a kind of sticky webbing that mats them together. Conversely, our uniqueness at this point exists solely in potential. It does not exert a strength of presence that can override the more primitive attachments of the gevurot that rule our unconscious backsides. In a back-to-back relationship, the herd instinct predominates over the drive to individuate. Nisirah, surgical uncoupling. Since enmeshment is produced by affinities that are unconscious and generic in the first stage, its severing occurs when the parties become self-aware and start to differentiate. Yet this awakening, so this is important, that this awakening, as a person becomes more self-aware and kind of sees like experiences themselves as different and distinct, overlapping but also distinct from the herd, the just the more herd instincts and the more herd assumption in the humans ecosystem, the herd's imperatives and assumptions and all that. So this, as a person awakens, it also triggers, and they begin to see their uniqueness, but also their difference. It often triggers shame, which actually opposes the task at hand. Evolutionary psychologists argue that shame evolved to inhibit behaviors that would estrange a person from community and the protection afforded by tribal affiliation. In the Nisi'ra process, two kinds of shame arise. One, community is an entity unto itself, a higher order unity with a survival instinct all its own. Since it's true that there is strength in numbers, the community weakens when its census decreases. Consequently, its survival instinct actively discourages the individuation of its members by shaming their attempts to distinguish themselves. I'm sure you've seen this at the principle operating at work. This is not a conscious strategy, but a survival reflex of the herd, of the community, that operates through the unconscious fears and vulnerabilities of its citizens. So this first element of shame that arises in the individuation process is the shame that comes from the community who which like kind of is uses sarcasm or whatever to create discomfort in its individuals as they begin to break out of the herd and into their and stepping into their unique and individual selves, that there is a the community is threatened by that in a kind of unconscious way and acts to pull the person back into the herd by shaming their aspiration to become a somebody. When we, and then the second kind of shame that is that plagues the individuation process is that when we as individuals begin our journey of self-discovery, we inevitably encounter thoughts and sensibilities that are not mirrored or even appreciated by others around us, our community. The more we delve into the mystery of our own self, the more differences we uncover between ourselves and our milieu. One definition of shame is the ego deflation that occurs when a bid for emotional communion elicits instead a response that is critical, indifferent, or contrary. Did you get that? I'm going to say it again. One definition of shame is the ego deflation that occurs when a bid for emotional communion elicits instead a response that is critical, indifferent, or contrary, produces shame. Thus, individuation inevitably produces shame. As we discover our unique selves, we seek approval from the world around us. Yet often that appreciation is not forthcoming, at least to the degree that it was sought. This lack of mirroring, of positive mirroring, produces some measure of shame, and this becomes a major challenge to the self-actualization that is a prerequisite to our mission of consummate union with Hashem. We must learn to bear the inevitable shame that accompanies this delicate nisirah, or surgical uncoupling. It helps to remember that the whole point of our uncoupling is to enable a higher, willful, and more rectified recoupling. This is very dense material, and I'm putting more than I should into the class, but I want to finish it right now so that we can go on next week to the more practical. It's a whole different section of the book, which is the more practical advice about how to work with shame. It's less
Kabbalistic. This is amazing. Sorry, Rudy. Don't worry. This is really, really amazing.
Okay.
We're with you.
Thanks. Okay. So the consummate front. So I'm going to try to finish. We'll go a little bit over, but not much. So then stage three is the consummate front-to-front encounter. This turning from back to front does not happen in one tectonic shift, but rather by increments, as I said earlier, sliver by sliver over time. In any given moment, there are unrectified layers enmeshed in a back-facing dysfunctional bond and rectified layers that are meeting metaphorically eye to eye, heart to heart. This is in every relationship, every marriage, our relationship with Hashem. It's in the process of moving from back to back into front to front. More and more of the psyche becomes involved in front-facing relationship with its partner. Then back to back. With each cycle of Nisira, the relationship deepens and sweetens as it turns ever more front to front. The more we unpack ourselves, the more content is available for front-facing union with Hashem. In this way, the burning shame that vexed our Nisira gets metabolized and manifests in phase three, according to Kabbalah, as Shilhuvin Derechimu, the flames of love. This term applies to the Gevurot, where they're fully unpacked and infused with conscious awareness, like a sponge that is infused with water, so the Gevurot, and expands as a result of that. So the Gevurot, when infused with conscious awareness, lighten and expand. And they are the source of this kind of ecstatic Shilhuvin Derechimu, flames of love, the primary contributor to the passion of that is from the Gevurot, not the Chasadim. The Gevurot infused with Chasadim, but it's the Gevurot that add the fire. This term applies to the Gevurot, that's what it says, when infused with conscious awareness and fully extended in both stature and radiance. This mature and enlightened Ani now enjoys a consummate Devekut with Hashem, a meeting of tip to toe, a pleasure beyond all earthly delights. Yet there is always a new frontier. The purpose of creation is achieved as we spend our eternity in an ever-deepening union and reunion with our Creator. Okay, so that's the section. And so next week, we're going into practical tools for processing shame. Any questions?
I want to say, I have something else, but I don't know that there's time, just about how I relate to the Gevurot and the conscious awareness and grow through joy.
Malka Sima, we can't hear you.
Ah, is this better? Now you hear me?
A bit closer to the mic, wherever it is.
I want to say how, is this any better?
Yes.
Yeah? So should I still yell? Yeah.
Yes.
Just how painful, it's like the opposite of circle consciousness. This truth about how people are shamed for being different In our Bluma Shainlin are doing this chabura in the Golan, and we did an exercise. Who here is has family in Israel? Who here is ready for Mashiach? Who here? And not everybody steps in, and the shame of being different, of just being who I am, and exploring that, and seeing, oh, who's the same, who's different, like celebrating. It's just such. I'm pained as you're reading about how in community and that. It's like such the opposite of circle consciousness.
But it is, I mean,
Cool.
as I was reading it this evening, I was thinking that it is kind of like the pushing a convert away three times and having to and them having to just push, yeah, I'm doing this, I'm doing this, I'm doing this, that there is a certain strength of commitment that is going to serve that person when they and they're going to need that to survive being a Jew among Jews. It's not this, we're a tough lot. And so I think here as well that the having to push through the shame in order to really fully individuate. So then your individuation is going to have a strength to it that it will be able to bear the difficulties that are inevitably going to come up in life. Like they say that, I don't know if it's really true, but it's interesting that if you see a butterfly trying to, kind of come out of its cocoon and it's like just can't seem to get its wings out, if you help it to get its wings out, it will die because it doesn't have the musculature it needs to be able to flap enough to survive. And so, all these
We have so much built-in shame, like the acceptance for ourselves for being who we are. Like as I kind of know more things about myself, I see the, like, is that okay? That's who I, it's like owning it. I just feel like there's so much shame we have to get from all
Right.
directions.
It is true. It is true. It is true. There is a lot of shame in the individuation process. There really is.
Wow. Okay, it's late. I have more to say, but it's late. I'm gonna, and we'll pass it along. Kayla's had her hand up.
Okay, Kayla.
Thank you so much. I feel like as you were reading it, I was like, this is like the story of my life. And I feel like I, like, and just like getting the bare beginning of encountering it. It's so meaningful. There's like a question that's been sitting with me. I don't know how detailed it is, like to unpack it, but when there's this concept of like Oyur de Tohu with Kalim of Tikkun, is it related to the journey of Gvuras and Chasadim or no?
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the Kalim or the Gevurot really that are needing to be infused with the Chasadim and the lights of Tikkun. Yeah.
So it's like a flip that it's not the kelim that bring the tikkun, it's the lights that bring the tikkun to the vessels.
It's the combination of them both, but yeah, it is the lights that bring the tikkun to the kalim.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, I mean it's actually it's a joint, it's a partnership.
Because I've heard this concept of like the lights that are chaotic and the vessels that are like sturdy and solid, but here it sounds less like
Yeah,
that.
right. I mean, because really, it's all light, so the vessels are just thick light, dense light, dark light. But yeah, but that the lights of Tikkun, those are ordered. Like that's the whole thing of Tikkun as opposed to Tohu. So the lights of Tikkun and the Kalim of, I mean, that's one of the things is that the Kalim were not really evolved in a way to be able to hold the lights of Tikkun. And so they That's part of the shattering that happened. And then, well, that's a whole other story. It's in a very interesting one, though. Because that's kind of what's happening in the background. But yeah. Yvonne, you were going to ask something?
Yeah, I might be pushing in the direction of the whole other story, but I heard it was the first time that I heard you say that the Hasidim and Gevurot are at the level of Ein Sof. And that kind of like I feel like I've never been able to kind of picture like where these things are, how they operate. I know that's like not even the
Right.
right, like the where is not even the right question, but is there anything more you can say about that?
That is what I'm writing about, really, about
Oh yeah.
exactly that confusion and how to explain it and how it really does become, on some level, the Kabbalah of the feminine in the end. So that's what it's going to be
Okay.
short because I want to get it, I want to be done with
Okay.
it
Well, but wait, with bated breath.
already. But yeah. Any other questions, comments?
Okay, I'm gonna throw it in. One of the paths to grow through joy is this consciousness.
We can't
When
hear you.
we bring our consciousness, now do you hear me? When we
More or
bring
less.
our consciousness, it's like the chassadim, we bring them into the unconscious places, and the which are just laced with shame. When we have a trigger, when the shame shows up, we turn the light of our consciousness to it, and we bring connection, maybe with compassion, and we start to like the light that's in there starts to kind of unfurl, and
Well,
there's a
the
proactive, yeah.
Gevurot are what really unpack primarily. The lights are more watery, they just infuse, and the Gevurot are what's unpacking.
That's like such a my experience in a somatic, like the body, like you can feel where if you listen in where in the body is it being experienced, and then the body will start, you can follow it. It starts, movement happens, it shifts, it like the consciousness is there witnessing that, but it's happening. It's on maybe with conscious content, maybe without. But that transformation is happening from, I think Gevurot, I'm saying, is within in the body or that unconscious. It just feels like a proactive and some growth through joy that you with the compassion bringing with connection support in doing it feels, yeah. Feels
Right. I
important.
mean, yeah. Lisa?
Hi, thank you. This is wonderful. So, thank you so much for your teachings and being here with everyone. I have a question about this concept of the Gevurot and the shame. Do we, certain people have come into the world with more shards or multiple shames, or as we evolve, if we move through something that is a shame in our life, how does that work? Do other ones pop up, or we're constantly working on, I mean, is that just our individuation? Each soul comes in with different.
Yeah, I mean, it's called the Kivshei Derachmana, the inscrutable mystery of the merciful one's design, that the re you know like some people have just are just have a hard life, and it's kind of they came in with that, and it just has accompanied them all the way through. And other people, have an easy go of things, and it's like The Kivshei de Rachmana, that term, is saying that there is no, it is, don't try to explain it logically because it's coming from a place that is way beyond human logic, and you just have to trust the mystery of it. And at some point in some millennia down the road, we'll kind of understand what it was all about, but it really is basically just accepting the mystery of our particular chelik, our portion of the universe that is our job to unpack and to mitakein.
Thank you. I asked something.
Who?
I
Shoshana?
Malky was the
Where?
Mal, my name is Malky.
Okay.
If we're individuating away from community, is the goal to remain completely individual of community, or is there a role for community to remain within that individuation process?
I mean, every path is different, but it certainly doesn't require a severing from community. I mean, ideally it wouldn't. One would have a healthy relationship with community and ideally be supported. But if you're not supported in your individuality, in your individuation, but even if not supported, that you kind of have a you have enough of a stubborn neck to be able to hold your own in the face of a community that's trying to reabsorb you back into it.
Thank you.
Sorry, Judith, can I ask a question? It's Cassia.
Yeah, we're almost done. So this is the last question. I mean, we're
Okay,
over
great.
time. Yeah.
Okay, thank you for taking my question, and just for these classes, it's so amazing. So I was wondering about with Chava,
With
I'm
what?
trying to put together with
Chava?
Chava, yeah, I'm trying to put together this idea of Chava Rishona and Chava Shnia. And if I understand correctly, if Chava Rishona kind of was she who or who was the Chava that did the sin? Like, was Chava
Really?
Rishona in that?
I think that it's. I have a poem verse that I wrote about the evolving feminine. I'll send it to you because it's Chava Rishona. In some sense, I was describing today was the back-to-back relationship, Nisi Ra, and turning front to front. And it's one way of understanding Chava Rishona is really just Chava in a back-facing, Chava and Adam in their back-facing starting point, and the chet is their nisira, is their surgical uncoupling, and then they meet front to front and begin a life together. And I think that becomes clearer in this teaching from, let me find out what I have it here. Oh. I don't have a copy of it. I don't have a copy of it here. Do you have poem verse too?
I'm actually looking at my shelves now. I don't know if I think I just have the first one. I just have
I
this.
have it if you want me to tell if you I have it in front of me if you want to tell me what page.
Oh,
It's Michal
yeah.
Lamba.
So look
That
in
could be
the
easier.
table of contents.
Okay.
And there should be like
I see
what's
yours
the
now. Hold on. And what will it say?
say what's it say?
What would be the title of
Just
that?
because it should be obvious. Is it?
Map of Feminine Development,
Yeah.
78. The Book of
Yeah.
Esther as a Map of Feminine Development. Okay, let me just put my video on. That won't be so rude. Hold on. Okay. That one? Okay, page 71.
It's a long, I mean, I'm not saying we're going to read it right now, but I think
Right. Oh,
it would
don't
be.
read it right now? Okay. You want me to read a little bit or something?
No, I don't think so. I think it's too much for that. It's,
What year
was
is
in
it?
a
That
he was
makes
in
it.
an Adar when there were two Adars.
2007.
Yeah. 2007.
You can look on the website, the Still Small Voice, and go to the Purim in 2007.
The website's just getting repaired, so I don't know if it's yet available, if you can do that, but it's worth a try.
If
It's
you do send
how
it
much
out,
is
can you
it?
send it to all of
Yeah, I could do that. I could
Thank
do
you.
that. I could send a link, yeah.
Yeah, it
Okay,
is quite
quite
amazing.
long.
That's amazing. Thank you, Sarita. Thank you.
Okay. So next week we're going to come down into practicalities.
Thank you.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Thank you.
everybody.
Shavua Tov, everyone.
Shavua Tov.
Thank
Thank you.
you.
Bye bye.
Shavua Tov. Miss Heisler or Mrs. Heisler, are you from Boston? Or did she hang up already?